Welcome back to Beta. I'm Doug Gordon. When Ken Burns went looking for a country music expert, he looked no further than Wisconsin's Bill Malone. He's the author of Country Music USA. Bill's with us now to talk about his lifelong passion. Bill, you say that you were born into country music. How so?
Well, it's the first music I ever heard. I like to think that the music my mother sang was country music. She didn't know where it came from. Some of it came from the church. She was an ardent Pentecostal, and she poured out her heart in music. Songs like Farther Along and We'll Understand It Better By and By. That was a way of coping with a semi-isolated existence on a East Texas cotton farm. So I heard her singing, and I knew how much that music meant to her, and it rubbed off on me. And then, of course, in 1939, a daddy came in with a Philco battery-powered radio. But as far as my life's work was concerned, although I didn't realize it at the time, it introduced me to what I call the radio hillbillies, the country musicians who came to us from radio stations in Dallas and Fort Worth, Tyler, Shreveport, Tulsa, and eventually from Nashville over the Grand Ole Opry. And so I grew up listening to those people. It's kind of an unusual paradox the way I looked at them. In one sense, I thought of them as being exotic beings, you know, because they sang about the Texas plains and the southern mountains and about lonely hobos. It seemed like a world far from what we were experiencing. But at the same time, they also seemed like they could be brothers or cousins. They sounded like us, and they went out of their way to create a family feeling. They made us think that we were part of the family. When they offered their picture songbooks for sale, we bought them. If they suggested a certain product that we ought to buy, we'd buy it. But above all, we listened to their music, and so I never realized that the music I love could be the basis for an academic study.
Yeah.
And it became that at the University of Texas at Austin.
Do you remember some of the first artists you heard on the old Philco radio? Some particular songs that really resonated with you?
One song in particular will always be a cherished memory. It was one called The Last Letter. People still sing that today. But we heard a man named Rex Griffin singing it. Rex was like so many of the country musicians at that time. He was an itinerant. He moved from one radio station to another until the territory was played out, as they called it. Then he would move on to another station. But we had a guitar. My older brother worked real hard for a neighbor to get a real cheap, probably a Sears Roebuck guitar. He started learning a few chords on it. And then my next brother, who's still alive, he picked it up too. And by the time I came along, I was 8 years younger than they were. And when I started playing the guitar, I made it a point to learn on that same song, The Last Letter, with my mother sitting by, you know, and give me encouragement, telling me when I needed to change chords. I said, "Oh, you got to change there, Billy," you know.
Why do you treat me as if I were only a friend? What have I done that has made you so different and cold? Sometimes I wonder if you'll be contented again. Will you be happy when you are withered and old?
So, yeah, you got yourself a guitar. You used your brother's guitar, as you said. And then at some point you started singing at bars and parties, right? What songs did you sing?
Okay, well, I sang all my life.
Mm-hmm.
But when I went to the University of Texas in 1954, I went down as a junior, and I became kind of notorious for, you know, I was singing all the time. I'd sing walking down the halls and just sitting in the office or just humming a song.
Sure.
But then some of my friends, about the time we entered graduate school, we began singing at parties, and then we went out to this now famous bar in North Austin called Threadgill's. And I remember very well around 1962 probably, a little group from the University of Texas Folk Music Club came out too. They heard that there was music out there. And among the people who came out was Janis Joplin.
Huh.
At that time, she was strumming an auto harp and singing with a little group called the Waller Creek Boys.
Mm.
But she, of course, disease is a disease from the very beginning, that she had a voice that surpassed any that we had. And she wasn't there very long until she went to California and became the great rock star that she was.
Well, one side is the life of a millionaire. Spending my money, Lord, and care. Taking my friends out for a mighty good time.
And while I was at the University of Texas, one day I was just browsing in the Austin Public Library, or one of its branches, and I came across a boxed collection of what was described on the cover as folk music. It turned out to be a part of the great collection that Harry Smith had been collecting years. And it was called the Anthology of American Folk Music.
Sure.
I was really bowled over by it. But for one thing, it introduced me to people I had not heard before, like Charlie Poole and Blind Willie Johnson and Blind Lemons, on and on. I'm convinced that's the single most important folk music recording ever made.
You tell me, who's that riding?
John the Revelator.
Who's that riding?
John the Revelator.
Who's that riding?
John the Revelator.
And it was also a turning point in my career. It gave a kind of a validity, a kind of a sanction for what I'd been singing and now was beginning to treat as an academic exercise.
Yeah, so let's talk about that, how that the academic exercise, as you call it, how that came about. You were at the University of Texas at Austin. This was, I think, 1954 is when you enrolled, and then you had this life-changing moment in 1960. Can you tell me about that?
I got all three of my degrees at UT Austin. I had no earthly idea about what I wanted to write about. And my supervising professor was a fellow named Joe Franz. One day, I took a trip with him and a couple of other graduate students down to Houston to watch the Texas Longhorns play in the Bluebonnet Bowl against Alabama. And we sang all the way down there. And then at dinner time, I believe it was that first evening, just out of the blue, Dr. Franz said, "Well, you know, you love this music so much. Why don't you write a history of Nashville publishing?" And I thought, "You mean you can actually write on something you love? That's unheard of." So I got into the subject and wrote not just a history of Nashville public, but a general history of the entire phenomenon. Country music, I tackled its folk music beginnings before commercialization. Then I picked up with radio and recording and talked about how it evolved over the years. Mm-hmm. So that's the way Country Music USA came about.
I'm curious about, how did performing country music, playing it and singing it, how did that influence the way you wrote about country music?
I think it helped me to understand where the music came from. It helped me to understand what it meant to people, because I knew what it had meant to my own family. And so I think I had an understanding that people coming from outside might not have had. On the other hand, it probably made me blind to certain features of the music. At first, I didn't realize just how nativist and jingoistic it could be. And I don't think people thought much about that at the time. I didn't realize just how neglected women had been. Women were part of the music from the time it was commercialized, but they were generally made to feel subordinate to the men in the business. And of course, I didn't really realize just how eclectic, how broad-based the music was at the time, just how strongly African-American culture had touched the music from the beginning and how it continued to do so throughout its history.
Well, can you get a man? But now she's gone, I don't worry. I'm sitting on top of the world.
Your dissertation was published in 1968 as the book Country Music USA, which is considered by many to be the Bible of country music. What were you trying to do? What were you trying to accomplish when you wrote it?
I felt like that the general history needed to be told quickly, because I wasn't sure what was going to happen to this music. Because rock and roll had come along first with Elvis in 1954, and then the record companies, one after another, began looking for people who could who sounded like Elvis, and the performers themselves began to change their styles and adapt them to also to meet the needs of this new youth audience that was becoming paramount in the United States. Because there was a period of time there when traditional country music, as I knew it, virtually disappeared from the jukeboxes and from the radio DJ shows. You couldn't hear a fiddle or a steel guitar. I want to tell the story of this music, well, it needs to be told, and when there are still people around who can tell me the story.
You've been married to your wife, Bobby, for more than 40 years, I think, right?
About 42.
Yeah. How did you meet her?
I met her in a honky-tonk.
How appropriate, yeah.
What kind of music do you usually have here?
Oh, we got both kinds. We got country and western.
I had a band in New Orleans, a bluegrass band called the Hill Country Ramblers. And one evening, she came out to the bar with a colleague of mine from the history department, and she came in and sat on the front row, and she'll tell you, and I agree, that was love at first sight. She was just fascinated by this guy up on the stage, this professor who was singing these honky-tonk songs. And I was fascinated by her, big smile and bright eyes. And so,
do you remember what song you were playing when you saw
each other?
Yeah, I was
singing Driving Nails in My Coffin.
Yeah, it's an Ernest Tubbs song, right?
Yeah.
I'm just driving nails in my coffin. Every time I drink a bottle of booze, I'm just driving nails in my coffin. Lordy, driving those nails over you.
And she learned that I had a mandolin in the closet. She wanted to be part of what I was doing. See, we got the mandolin out of the closet, and a friend taught her a few chords on it. And we did our first show at a Presbyterian church on St. Charles. I was doing a kind of a history of gospel music, how it evolved over the years. And in the middle of one song, you know, she forgot the words. And she went in the back room, and when I got back there, she was crying. She said, I'll never try to play again. I said, yes, you are. We're going to start playing at a coffee house. We're going to play every week, and you're going to get over your stage fright. We're going to learn how to play. So we've been trying to do it ever since.
I want to ask you about one of the all-time country greats, George Jones, who has been described as the Frank Sinatra of country music. What's your take on Jones?
I think he's the greatest singer country music ever had.
Yeah.
He might be as good as anybody in the pop ranks of any type.
Do you have a favorite George Jones song?
The Grand Tour.
Yeah, that's a classic, yeah.
I almost get swallowed up by the instrumentation, but he puts his heart and soul into it. You can feel his anguish, and I think that's the mark of a great country singer. He or she can make you think that the song is written specially for you. See, I understand what you're going through, because I've gone through it too.
There's her rings, all her things, and her clothes are in.
Who are the most influential women in the history of country music?
Kitty Wells has to be toward the top.
Yeah.
Because this unassuming and just as non-threatening as any woman could be, but yet was singing songs like It Wasn't God Who Made Honky Tonk Angels. And I think she gave encouragement to other women to sing. So she influenced a lot of the women who came along in the early and mid-1950s. Of course, then Patsy Cline.
Yeah.
Patsy Cline was such a great singer that she quickly lost identification as a country singer.
Yeah, she transcended country and became known in the pop circles.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's kind of interesting because when she started out, she wanted to do straight country. She wanted to dress like a cowgirl, which she did. And she resisted at first some of the songs that became big hits for her. But when they did, and today, you know, you go almost anywhere in the country, restaurant or supper club, and in the background you can hear some Patsy Cline being sung.
Your cheating heart will make you weep. You'll cry and cry and try to sleep.
What do you think of today's contemporary country music?
Well, when I want to listen to country music, I generally pull out my CDs and old records.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm still looking for old-time songs that I haven't heard lately or never have heard. And in today's scene, I look for people who don't necessarily imitate the past, but they build upon it.
Yeah.
They have a sense of roots. They seem to have a reverence for the working class roots of the music. And then they take that and go and make their own sound. I'm referring to people like Tim O'Brien.
Yeah.
Who I think is the most versatile person out there today playing.
Yeah.
Iris DeMent.
Oh, yeah. She's great. Yeah.
Everybody is wondering what and where they all came from. Everybody is worrying about where they're going to go when the whole thing's done. But no one knows for certain, and so it's all the same to me. I think I'll just let the mystery be.
You've been working with Ken Burns on this new documentary series about country music that's scheduled to air in the fall. Can you tell me about what that experience has been like working with Ken?
Oh, it's wonderful. I've for a few years now, I've been a consultant to the Ken Burns program. I read scripts and critique them and send them back. And then I believe it was in 2014, I went to New York and was interviewed for 2 or 3 hours. So they asked me questions spanning the entire history of country music.
Right, so you're going to show up as one of the talking heads in the documentary.
Yeah. And we, October of last year, I guess it was, we went to Walpole, New Hampshire, and sat down and watched the pre-screening. It was just a wonderful experience almost everybody was tearful by the time it was over.
Yeah.
You know, for one thing, to think of all the people that you see on the screen who have died since the filming began. In my case, you know, I was tearful because I remember any time I start talking about my mother, I'm like likely to break into tears. But she's the person that introduced me to this music, and to me, it's her culture. And I'm just pleased that I'm able to keep it alive and to document it and to commemorate it. So I felt, as I watched the Ken Burns screening, I felt this is a validation of my life's work and of the music that I've always loved.
Bill Malone is the author of Country Music USA. You can see him in Ken Burns' documentary, Country Music. You can find out more at WPR.org/beta.
When I started comedy, any images of Muslims that I saw on TV or in media or, you know, there was a fear. So I have to give them another alternative to this identity.
That's comedian Zainab Johnson. She'll join us next when Beta returns on Wisconsin Public Radio.